Today, we are going to take a trip from Crocs to Balenciaga, and it's all going to make sense, I promise. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Oakland, I'm Molly Wood, in for Kai Rizdahl. It is November 29th, happy day after Thanksgiving, and thanks for joining us. I say day after Thanksgiving, you say Black Friday, tomato, tomato. But the fact is that even if we're kind of exhausted by Black Friday marketing, and we are, consumer spending is the linchpin of the American economy, and a lot of budgets will be made or broken in the next few weeks of shopping. So let's talk about that and the other top economic stories of the week in the Weekly Wrap. Joining me today, John Harwood of CNBC. Welcome.
Hey, Molly.
So let's talk about that, the American consumer. They're expected to do a lot of work today and in the next couple of weeks. And I wonder, you know, we've talked a lot about economic indicators and stagnant wages and all of these sort of factors that weigh into keeping the economy afloat. How much weight are we putting on the consumer's shoulders?
Well, of course, consumer spending is 70% of the economy, and we've gotten conflicting signals just in recent days about the mood of the consumer. Confidence, as measured by the Conference Board, was down 4 months in a row. The University of Michigan's index is actually up a little bit. We know that the holiday shopping season is a week shorter because of the late Thanksgiving. It's very difficult to predict. Last year, we had robust confidence going into the holiday season, and we had weak sales. So we're all going to discover in the next few days what kind of start it's off to and what that might portend for 2020.
Right. And then, you know, on the other hand, you had, I thought, uncharacteristically positive news from Fed Chair Jerome Powell, who earlier this week said the economy is, quote, more than half full. I mean, did the interest rate cuts really work that well?
Hard to tell. And there's a lag in terms of the effectiveness of Fed interest rate cuts. But I do think that Jay Powell has been signaling that he doesn't want to stay indefinitely on that path. Clearly, he's gotten a lot of pressure from the White House. He doesn't want to be too accommodating to that pressure because the Fed's an independent agency, of course. And I think what Jay Powell was trying to signal was don't count on further interest rate cuts. We do have, even though the economy is slowing from the pace that it reached in 2018, it's still essentially growing at a 2% rate, which is the baseline of the growth potential of the economy. That's where it was when Barack Obama left office. That's where it is now. And you don't want it to try to run it too hot.
Well, and I know that this is the big shopping day. I feel like today also marks the official start of the look ahead season, where we look ahead to the next year. And the Wall Street Journal is reporting today that analysts think 2020 won't be as good a year for the stock market as 2019. Sort of speaking of mixed messages, like spending might be okay, the economy might be fine, growth might be fine, the stock market might be, heaven forbid, single-digit increases in 2020. What do you think of all of this?
Well, I think that's right. And it reflects the mixed signals, not just on consumer spending or consumer sentiment, as we talked about before, but also on where the economy's trajectory is right now. Recession risks have gone up. It's probably not a majority. That's not the base case for 2020, although the uncertainty of the trade war with China puts a question mark over that. But I think it's inevitable that the deeper we get into this economic recovery, which is getting into its 10th year, the longer that goes on, the likelier it is that we're going to get a downturn. And it's natural that people would expect a more temperate rate of growth in stocks.
All right. So it all sounds just about fine. John Harwood
fine.
Of CNBC. Thanks so
mezzo,
much.
Mezzo, mezzo.
Fine.
You
mezzo,
bet.
Mezzo, mezzo. On Wall Street today, predictions of a stock market slowdown might already be coming true. Then again, maybe people are just cashing out to buy new TVs. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. All All right, let's talk about disruption for a minute, because this next story is a textbook example of what new technologies can do to an established industry. The auto industry, in this case, which is marching toward electric cars. To fund that march, Daimler, owner of Mercedes-Benz, is cutting at least 10,000 jobs by 2022. Rival German carmaker Audi recently announced similar job cuts for similar reasons. Marketplace's Andy Euler has more on all of that.
The automotive industry is in the middle of the biggest transformation in its history. Not my words, that's what Daimler said in a statement announcing the job cuts today.
I think it's a reasonable statement.
That's Charles Hill. He teaches management at the University of Washington. He says there are two factors at play in auto companies cutting jobs. For one, demand is softening. China bought 10% more cars last year than this one. That's thanks in no small part to the trade war between Washington and Beijing. The other factor, electrification.
We seem to be close to an inflection point in terms of demand and production for electric vehicles. And I think the automobile companies are looking ahead to that. And they're starting to make fairly aggressive investments.
Because he says those investments have to happen to keep up with the Teslas of the world. And the workforce is going to be different. Electric cars have fewer parts and require fewer workers to assemble.
The foundations of electrification and electric powertrain are far simpler than the complexities of internal combustion engines.
Brian Reamer is a research scientist at MIT. He says automakers will be hiring fewer engineers and perhaps more computer programmers and artificial intelligence experts in the future.
A lot of the legacy components aren't going to be so prevalent down the road.
Daimler currently has a global workforce of nearly 300,000 people. It runs factories in 17 countries. The company said earlier this month it needed to trim 10% of its global management ranks to, quote, increase competitiveness, innovation, and investment strength. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
There were reports early this morning that Black Friday was actually off to a bit of a chill start. People were not breaking down doors and getting in fights in the parking lot. I mean, why bother when sales are just a click away online? Research from Adobe predicts online sales will jump 20% this Black Friday over last year. But wait, this is not that story, because some shoppers are still headed out into the parking lots and the physical stores. And it's not the shoppers you might think. Here's Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino with more on that one.
The crowds were thin at a downtown shopping district in Pasadena, California this morning, but 18-year-olds Elena Osterman and Jolene Murphy were out deal hunting.
Yeah, we've never been Black Friday shopping before,
yeah,
so we thought we'd try it, but it seems kind of not a thing anymore.
But it turns out it is still a thing with people their age. A survey by the National Retail Federation found the demographic most likely to shop in-store this Black Friday were also the youngest, known as Generation Z, the oldest of which are now in their late teens and early 20s.
This is the first generation of true digital natives, so it really stands out to us how much they embrace the store.
Catherine Cullen with the National Retail Federation says despite or maybe because of younger consumers' reliance on technology, they view shopping in person as entertainment and a social activity.
And that's social whether they're there physically with other people or sharing what they're doing in the store through their social channels.
Black Friday particularly appeals to Gen Z's love of deals, according to Jason Dorsey with the Center for Generational Kinetics. Of course, being young, they don't have a ton of money, but he says they also were influenced by growing up during the Great Recession.
Gen Z was old enough to understand what was going on, to feel the anxiety, the stress, and the pressure of it, and yet they were young enough for it to still change their values.
But he says this generation has high expectations for convenience, and many end up just pulling out their phone while in store if they encounter long lines or better prices online. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
All right, so how did this consumer tradition of Black Friday come into being, you might ask? Well, we've got all the details on the history on our Alexa skill. If you've got an Echo device, just say, "Make me smart," and take a listen. Now for a story about love and compromises. When you're in a new relationship, you have to navigate all this money etiquette. Do you split the check at a restaurant? Can your partner afford tickets to a fancy show? How much is too much to spend on gifts? Rima Kreiss is host of Marketplace's podcast called This Is Uncomfortable. She's been looking into how we spend money in relationships, and she brings us this story of one couple who tries to show their love for each other in a way that neither of them actually loves.
If Mandy Cuhy and Zach Amen were TV characters, they'd be Luke and Lorelai from Gilmore Girls. They even dressed up as them one year for Halloween. Zach, like Luke, is a no-nonsense guy.
I am a man of few words, and it's like I say just enough to like get the point across, and there's no need for any of the extra.
And Mandy's got strong Lorelai vibes, super chatty and confident. The two had been dating for 3 months when Valentine's Day rolled around, and Zach really wanted to impress Mandy.
And so he's like, hey, come sit down. I bought you like a Valentine's Day present.
So Mandy sat down on the couch and Zach handed her a gift.
So I really love elephants, and he had bought me this really cute elephant necklace. And I was like, oh my gosh, thank you so much. I was so stoked. I was like, thank you. Start to get up to like give him a hug. And he's like, no way, I have more. And I was like, okay. So then he brings this like package and I unwrap it, and it's these like six glass roses, which was truly beautiful. But I was like, this is like a lie. Like, what's happening?
She thanked him, got ready to get up, and Zach was like, wait, there's more. Open this one.
And it's this like really cute Michael Kors jacket. And I loved Michael Kors. I was like 22 and like I was like obsessed with Michael. It was like really endearing, but like simultaneously mad uncomfortable, but I can't tell him.
She didn't say anything. It's too early in their relationship for that. Then a few months later, it's Zach's 25th birthday, and Mandy came up with a plan.
So I am like, okay, maybe his thing is multiple gifts. So it was his 25th birthday, so I'm not joking. I bought 25 presents.
She went over to his apartment while he was at work and laid them all out.
And then he, like, comes in from work, and he just is like, hi. I'm like, I bought you 25 presents because you bought me so many. And literally, he just stands there, and he's like, what?
That's so uncomfortable.
He was super uncomfortable. I had no idea.
Here's the thing. Zach actually hates getting gifts. But he didn't tell Mandy that. He just smiled and gave her a big hug. How much money do you think you spent?
If I had to put money on it, I would probably say like $400.
I think mine was close. It was probably $350 maybe.
Oh, wow. Without even realizing it, Mandy and Zach had created what felt like a gift-giving arms race. Then, a couple months later, they take this silly online love languages quiz. And their results show that both of them don't care for gift-giving as a form of expressing love. It was this moment of confusion, but also relief.
Oh, wait. Oh, you don't like gifts? Okay, I don't like gifts either.
Okay, let's rewind and try to figure out what happened. Thinking back on Valentine's Day, Zach says he thought he was doing what Mandy wanted. He remembers being taken aback the first time he visited her family in Dallas. Their home was in this neighborhood with long driveways and big backyards. Meanwhile, he had spent part of his childhood living in a double-wide trailer in a very small town in Oklahoma. Was there a part of you, even if it was just like a small voice, that was like, what if she doesn't like me? Like, you know, can I fit into this world?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So that's why on Valentine's Day, he went all out. He wanted to send a message to Mandy that,
hey, even though I don't have a lot of money, I'm willing to spend it on you.
But yeah, that just made Mandy uncomfortable. She definitely grew up in a family that gave a lot of gifts, but she says she didn't expect that from her partner.
I didn't think that he needed to purchase all of these things to show me that he cared about me.
Zach and Mandy ended up having a huge conversation about gifts, and they came up with a plan. They put spending limits on gift giving around the holidays.
I think our relationship with money has changed in that we're both willing to compromise and just communicate about it.
So, you know, they don't end up with a closet full of unnecessary gifts. I'm Erin Mejres for Marketplace.
Now, this being the day after Thanksgiving, a lot of Americans are not at work today. But if you do happen to be working through the holidays and you've tried to email anybody, you probably got one of those automated out-of-office email messages. Well, we highlight some of the more creative versions in our occasional series, Automatic Reply.
Hey there. I am currently out of the office on vacation. If you are in need of assistance regarding pipettes, reach out to Linda. If you are in need of assistance regarding anything else in the facilities, reach out to Sharon. If you are in need of moral support, well, you can do this, and I believe in you. Thank you, and take care, David Bullock.
David Bullock is a laboratory technician in Durham, North Carolina. Tell us about an out-of-office email you've seen at marketplace.org. Coming up,
if it's good enough for Yves Saint Laurent or someone like that, then of course it's good enough for me.
I mean, ditto. But first, let's do the numbers. Markets closed in the red this Black Friday. The Dow Jones Industrial Average shed 112 points, 0.4% to close at 28,051. The NASDAQ fell 39 points, also 0.4% to finish at 86.65. And the S&P 500 was down 12 points, another 0.4% to finish at 31.40. For the week, though, the picture was much better. The Dow gained 0.2%, the NASDAQ climbed 1.7%, and the S&P rose 1%. And generally speaking, already today, retail is off to, well, a medium start. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.77%, and you're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Molly Wood. If you've been on TikTok lately or you have a teenager, you might be aware that Crocs, you know, the comfy clogs with the holes on top that were everywhere about a decade ago, are kind of hot right now. No, really, Crocs have gone viral. Teens are showing them off on social media. Artists and celebrities are doing collaborations with the brand. The rapper Post Malone even sang about them on his latest album. Rich on you, my watch, $1,000 Crocs, $1,000 Crocs, he said. And that is all kind of amazing considering that not too long ago, Crocs, the company, was on the brink of financial disaster. Andrew Rees is the current CEO of Crocs. He helped orchestrate the brand's turnaround. Andrew, welcome to the program.
My pleasure.
So the word on the street is that Crocs are back, not just back, but actually pretty cool again. And I wonder from your perspective, obviously, the business and you did a lot of work to turn the brand around. Did you also have just a bit of consumer luck in terms of preferences and this sort of move toward more comfortable, kind of cool, ugly style?
Look, I think there's always a little luck involved in these things and sort of feeding into understanding where trends are going and working towards them and feeding into them is part of what you do as you manage a brand. But, you know, we've been on a 4-year journey of kind of repositioning our product, repositioning our marketing and our go-to-market strategy. And, you know, while in some senses I think we'd say that's taken a little bit longer than we thought it was going to, it's been a very deliberate pathway.
Well, yeah, the deliberate part seems to be that you're capitalizing very well on the coolness. Crocs actually do seem to be legitimately cool. You're blowing up on TikTok. You're collaborating with Post Malone. Talk to me about how you sort of use the moment.
Yeah, I mean, so I think there's a couple of components to that. One big component is our product, right? So our classic clog, it's a blank canvas, right? So it can come in solid colors, it can be printed, it can be personalized with gibbets. So it's a vehicle we can use to do lots of different things, I would say relatively quickly. And so we have capitalized on what we saw as two major trends on a global basis. One is collaborations, but the second big trend that we saw that we capitalized on is this mega trend for personalization.
You mentioned repositioning the brand, and I think, you know, when Crocs initially came out and were incredibly popular, it wasn't necessarily with the sort of like cutting edge TikTok Post Malone consumer. How do you see your core consumer evolving over time?
That's a really good question. I think part of that initial positioning was what I describe as a haphazard distribution strategy. So your positioning is your product, who you market to, and also where you sell. And in those early days, they sold literally everywhere. So as we look forward, we think about two major customer groups that we serve. Our feel goods, which is really suburban mom and her family, very, very important customer group. We don't want to walk away from them, but they're probably not the growth driver for the future. So we wanted to move younger. We wanted to move a little bit hipper, a little bit trendy, a little bit more fashion forward, because A, they have spending power, B, they're on social media, and see through social media, they do influence a lot of other people. They influence their siblings, they influence their parents, they influence a wider group of people.
So talk to me about planning for the future then, because, you know, being somewhat dependent on what people think is cool can be a risky game. How do you plan for the next shift in preference?
Well, you have to remain very nimble. I would say as we look at 2020, we have a pretty robust pipeline of collaborations, and that could be celebrities, musicians, other brands, other retailers. But at the same time, we leave a lot of room in our calendar so that we can react to things that are coming up. And I think that's really, really important. This world is very dynamic in terms of tastes, trends, and things that are going on, and you need to be able to react.
And then comfortable footwear is a pretty vibrant marketplace right now. You obviously have lots of sneaker brands. You have new footwear brands like Native and Allbirds. Who do you think is your competition?
Yes, that's a very good question. So obviously, there's nobody exactly like us. When we look at the consumer, what we think about is who's buying products for wearing occasions that we can serve. So we think about the large athletic players, silhouette-specific competitors, whether that be a sandal manufacturer like a Birkenstock or a Havaianas, or whether that be a clog manufacturer like a Dansko. And we also think about other global brands like a Converse or a Vans. So it's a broad set of people. But I think the thing that we bring to the table is really comfort, and I think we fulfill very strongly against that.
Andrew Rees is president and CEO of Crocs, which are back. Andrew, thanks so much for the time.
Thank you, Molly. Pleasure.
A little more on fashion for a moment. If you look in your closet right now, you're likely to find a lot of rayon, polyester, nylon, what are called synthetic fabrics. We're not judging. This is actually the result of a very successful marketing campaign around 100 years ago that made synthetic fabrics what they are today. Cassia St. Clair wrote about the rise of synthetics in her book, The Golden Thread, How Fabric Changed History.
When synthetics were first being introduced to the market in the early decades of the 20th century, they were very unfamiliar. Quite exciting in some ways, but also regarded as inferior to the real thing, so inferior to things like cotton, linen, and silk. Companies that were producing synthetics had to woo the public into accepting these new unfamiliar textiles. And one way they did this was through branding, so the name seemed very futuristic and exciting. It's hard for us to think now that, you know, words like nylon and lycra might have had huge cachet. But at the time, that was sort of part of the thinking that went into it. But they also did other things to woo their consumers. So they worked with Parisian fashion designers and introduced their fabrics to them in the hopes that the designers would then use these new synthetics in their collections. You know, if it's good enough for Yves Saint Laurent or someone like that, then of course it's good enough for me. The other thing is they sort of introduced their products to the media. So there are some very interesting articles from this time about the new synthetic fabrics and the way they could help life for the average woman. The way you could, you know, if you were traveling, you know, take one dress, wash it, it would dry overnight, and then you could put it on and be fresh for your following day. And that just simply wouldn't have been possible with other fabrics. These new synthetics did have qualities that could make them very practical and useful. We can see now how incredibly successful these campaigns were. I think, you know, most of us would find the majority of our clothes either contain synthetics or are made wholly of synthetics. And it's something, you know, around 60 to 70% of all the clothes made now are made using synthetic fibers.
This final note before we go, still on fashion and Black Friday because I love a theme. You see, the death of retail may be at least temporarily great news for we consumers. Ad Age alerted me to the fact that the luxury retailer Barney's, which is in bankruptcy, now has to liquidate its entire inventory of high-end goods, meaning Barney's is having a huge Black Friday sale that actually started on Wednesday. This almost never happens in the land of Prada and Balenciaga and Christian Louboutin. In fact, analysts said sales like this on these kinds of goods are, quote, unprecedented. I'm just saying this Burberry belt bag is just $527. Yeah, no, okay, that's still insane. Never mind. All right, we got to go shopping. Today, the Dow shed 112 points. The NASDAQ was down 39 points. The S&P 500 was down 12 points, about 0.4%. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president and general manager. And I am Molly Wood. Kai Rizdahl will be done shopping by Monday. This is APM.